cell in the Ardfert barracks was my first. Then they took me to Tralee. All my joy had long since gone. I was back in Ireland, in jail. The chief constable of Tralee was very unfriendly to me. It was he got me the priest, and I said a lot of things to him during the night. Many of these things were in confidence, as at that time I was bent on taking the poison I had. I wanted this friendly man to tell my friends afterwards. But it was the following Wednesday evening I first tried to kill myself. After they'd shipped me to England and the Tower of London, I rubbed poison, curare, into a cut I made in my fingers, and thought surely I would go off that night. But I didn't. The Tower of London. I wonder how many other traitors tried to end their lives there before they were ended for them. At first I thought they were going to shoot me. But as the interrogations went on and on, I knew they were bent on making a big case out of it. I cannot dwell on the waiting part of it. It was dreary, and I remember wishing it was all over, and I could have peace. Good friends cheered me with their efforts to get me a proper defence. Alice Green, Gertrude Bannister, Conan Doyle. All I could contribute to my own defence was £25. Conan Doyle gave £700, they told me. What a farce a trial is. At Bow Street, when I first appeared, they actually had a detective inspector to prove that the war with Germany was on. And they described me as Sir Roger Casement, of no fixed abode and having no fixed occupation. How accurate. I remember feeling the unreality of that Bow Street hearing. The overture before the grand opera which was enacted at the Old Bailey. I actually laughed at some of the statements made by those Irish soldiers whom I was accused of suborning. Bitter laughter, I suppose, to see decent Irishmen playing into the hands of that man, Smith. Smith. What an irony. I bet none of the papers pointed that irony out. Smith, who helped Carson to agitate the north of Ireland to rebellion, prosecuting me for doing the same thing for the south. Mr. Attorney General Smith. What pleasure the whole charade was to him. I felt sick when he unfurled our Irish brigade flag in court and sneered at it. The Bow Street thing was quite an easy-going affair, for it was just the preliminary to the trial. The Old Bailey was a different matter. I felt tense and depressed throughout it. The only solace was in preparing my own speech. I let Sergeant Sullivan do my fighting for me. He knew, and I knew, it would be of no value anyway. Trial could have only one result. Guilty. But I was glad of its one opening. They had to let me speak. And I could use that stage to do some good for the Irish cause, if not for my own. It was like the Congo and Putumayo all over again, preparing that speech, making every word tell, writing and revising, polishing up this one last document. The whole trial passed like some dull nightmare until the final day, when the jury came back, looking as guilty as they had found me. I suppose all juries which have just decided to send a man to his death must look like that, eyes averted, strained, and nervous. How do you say? Do you find the prisoner, Sir Roger David Casement, guilty or not guilty of the high treason whereof he stands indicted? Guilty. You find Sir Roger David Casement guilty of high treason, and that is the verdict of you all? Yes. I stood there hearing it, hearing my death decided in that court, and felt nothing. It could not have happened any other way. I had heard that verdict in my mind for days. It came as no shock. Then came my chance, and the king's coroner asked me, "What have you to say for yourself? Why the court should not pass sentence and judgment upon you to die according to law?" This was the moment. Now was the time. My Lord Chief Justice, as I wish to reach a much wider audience than I see before me here, I intend to read all that I propose to say. What I shall read now is something I wrote more than 20 days ago. I may say, my lord, at once, that I protest against the jurisdiction of this court on this charge. And the argument that I am now going to read is addressed not to this court, but to my own countrymen. There is an objection, possibly not good in law, but surely good on moral grounds, against the application to me here of this old English statute, 565 years old, that seeks to deprive an Irishman today of life and honor, not for adhering to the king's enemy, but for adhering to his own people. When this statute was passed in 1351, what was the state of men's minds on the question of a far higher allegiance, that of a man to God and his kingdom? The law of that day did not permit a man to forsake his church or deny his God, save with his life. The heretic, then, had the same doom as the traitor. Today, a man may forswear God and his heavenly kingdom without fear or penalty, all earlier statutes having gone the way of Nero's edicts against the Christians. But that constitutional phantom, the king, can still dig up from the dungeons and torture chambers of the Dark Ages a law that takes a man's life and limb for an exercise of conscience. If true religion rests on love, it is equally true that loyalty rests on love. The law I am charged under has no parentage in love and claims the allegiance of today on the ignorance and blindness of the past. I am being tried in truth not by my peers of the live present, but by the peers of the dead past. Not by the civilization of the 20th century, but by the brutality of the 14th. Even by a statute framed in the language of an enemy land. So antiquated is the law that must be sought today to slay an Irishman whose offense is that he puts Ireland first. Loyalty is a sentiment, not a law.
It rests on love, not on restraint. The government of Ireland, by England, rests on restraint and not on law. And since it demands no love, it can evoke no loyalty. This court, this jury, the public opinion of this country, England, cannot but be prejudiced in varying degree against me, most of all in time of war. I did not land in England. I landed in Ireland. It was to Ireland I came. To Ireland I wanted to come. The last place I desired to land was England. But for the Attorney General of England, there is only England. There is no Ireland. There is only the law of England, no right of Ireland. The liberty of Ireland and of Irishmen is to be judged by the power of England. Yet to me, the Irish outlaw, there is a land of Ireland, a right of Ireland, and a charter for all Irishmen to appeal to in the last resort. A charter that even the very statutes of England itself cannot deprive us of. Nay, more, a charter that Englishmen themselves assert as the fundamental bond of law that connects the two kingdoms. This charge of high treason involves a moral responsibility, as the very terms of the indictment against myself recite, inasmuch as I committed the acts I am charged with to the evil example of others in the like case. What was the evil example I set to others in the like case? And who were these others? The evil example charged is that I asserted the rights of my own country, and the others I appealed to aid my endeavor were my own countrymen. The example was given not to Englishmen, but to Irishmen, and the like case can never arise in England, but only in Ireland. To Englishmen I set no evil example, for I made no appeal to them. I asked no Englishmen to help me. I asked Irishmen to fight for their rights. The evil example was only to other Irishmen who might come after me and, in like case, seek to do as I did. How then, since neither my example nor my appeal was addressed to Englishmen, can I be rightfully tried by them? If I did wrong in making an appeal to Irishmen to join with me in an effort to fight for Ireland, it is by Irishmen and by them alone I can be rightfully judged. From this court and its jurisdiction, I appeal to those I'm alleged to have wronged and to those I'm alleged to have injured by my evil example, and claim that they alone are competent to decide my guilt or my innocence. If they find me guilty, the statute may affix the penalty, but the statute does not override or annul my right to seek judgment at their hand. Place me before a jury of my own countrymen, be it Protestant or Catholic, Unionist or Nationalist, Sinn Féinic or Orangemen, and I shall accept the verdict and bow to the statute and all its penalties. But I shall accept no meaner finding against me than that of those whose loyalty I endanger by my example and to whom alone I made appeal. If they adjudge me guilty, then guilty I am. It is not I who am afraid of their verdict. It is the Crown. If this is not so, why fear the test? I fear it not. I demand it as my right. My lord, I beg to say a few more words. I would like to comment on the generous expressions of sympathy extended me from many quarters, particularly from America, that have touched me very much. In that country, as in my own, I am sure my motives are understood and not misjudged. For the achievement of their liberties has been an abiding inspiration to Irishmen and to all men elsewhere, rightly struggling to be free in like cause. Let me pass from myself and my own fate to a far more pressing, as it is a far more urgent, theme. Not the fate of the individual Irishman who may have tried and failed, but the claims and the fate of the country that has not failed. Ireland has outlived the failure of all her hopes, and yet she still hopes. Ireland has seen her sons, aye, and her daughters, meeting always the same fate, and always at the hands of the same power, and always a fresh generation has passed on to withstand the same oppression. For if English authority be omnipotent, a power, as Mr. Gladstone phrased it, that reaches to the very ends of the earth, Irish hope exceeds the dimensions of that power, excels its authority, and renews with each generation the claims of the last. The cause that begets this indomitable persistency, the faculty of preserving through centuries of misery the remembrance of lost liberty, this surely is the noblest cause men ever strove for, ever lived for, ever died for. If this be the case I stand here today indicted for, and convicted of sustaining, then I stand in a goodly company and a right noble succession. My counsel has referred to the Ulster Volunteer Movement, and I will not touch at length upon that ground, save only to say this, that neither I nor any of the leaders of the Irish Volunteers, who were founded in Dublin in November 1913, had quarrel with the Ulster Volunteers as such, who were born a year earlier. Our movement was not directed against them, but against the men who misused and misdirected the courage, the sincerity, and the local patriotism of the men of the north of Ireland. On the contrary, we welcomed the coming of the Ulster Volunteers, even while we deprecated the aims and intentions of those Englishmen who sought to pervert to an English party use to the mean purposes of their own bid for place and power in England the armed activities of simple Irishmen. We aimed at winning the Ulster Volunteers to the cause of a united Ireland. As Mr. Birrell said in his evidence recently laid before the Commission of Inquiry into the causes of the late rebellion in Ireland, the war upset all our calculations. It upset mine no less than Mr. Birrell's, and put an end to my mission of peaceful effort in America. War between Great Britain and Germany meant, as I believe, ruin for all the hopes we had founded on the enrollment of the Irish Volunteers. Then we were told that the first duty of an Irishman was to enter the British Army in return for a promissory note payable after death, a scrap of paper that might or might not be redeemed. It was then that I felt, over there in America, that my first duty was to keep Irishmen at home in the only army that could safeguard our national existence. If small nationalities were to be the pawns in this game of embattled giants, this great war, I saw no reason why Ireland should shed her blood in any cause but her own. And if that be treason beyond the seas, I am not ashamed to avow it or to answer for it here with my life. And when we had the doctrine of unionist loyalty at last, Mausers or Kaisers or any king you like, I felt I needed no other warrant than that these words conveyed to go forth and do likewise, like the leaders of the Ulster Volunteers. The difference between us was that the Unionist champions chose a path they felt would lead to the woolsack, while I went a road I knew must lead to the dock. And the event proves we were both right. The difference between us was that my treason was based on a ruthless sincerity that forced me to attempt in time and season to carry out in action what I said in word. Whereas their treason lay in verbal incitements that they knew need never be made good in their bodies. And so, I am prouder to stand here today in the traitor's dock to answer this impeachment than to fill the place of my right honorable accusers. We have been told, we have been asked to hope, that after this war, Ireland will get home rule as a reward for the lifeblood shed in a cause which, whoever else its success may benefit, can surely not benefit Ireland. And what will home rule be in return for what its vague promise has taken and still hopes to take away from Ireland? It is not necessary to climb the painful stairs of Irish history, a treadmill of a nation whose labors are as vain for her own uplifting as the convict's exertions are for his redemption, to review the long list of British promises made only to be broken, of Irish hopes raised only to be dashed to the ground. Home rule, when it comes, if come it does, will find an Ireland drained of all that is vital to its very existence, unless it be that unquenchable hope we build on the graves of the dead. We are told that if Irishmen go by the thousand to die, not for Ireland, but for Flanders, for Belgium, for a patch of sand on the deserts of Mesopotamia, or a rocky trench on the heights of Gallipoli, they are winning self-government for Ireland. But if they dare to lay down their lives on their native soil, if they dare to dream even that freedom can be won only at home by men resolved to fight for it there, then they are traitors to their country, and their dream and their debts alike are phases of a dishonorable fantasy. But history is not recorded in other lands. In Ireland alone, in this 20th century, is loyalty held to be a crime. Self-government is our right, a thing born in us at birth, a thing no more to be doled out to us or withheld from us by another people, than the right to life itself, than the right to feel the sun or smell the flowers or to love our kind. It is only from the convict these things are withheld for crime committed and proven. And Ireland, that has wronged no man, that has injured no land, that has sought no dominion over others, Ireland is treated today among the nations of the world as if she was a convicted criminal. If it be treason to fight against such an unnatural fate as this, then I am proud to be a rebel and shall cling to my rebellion with the last drop of my blood. If there be no right of rebellion against a state of things that no savage tribe would endure without resistance, then I am sure that it is better for men to fight and die without right than to live in such a state of right as this, where all your rights become only an accumulated wrong, where men must beg with bated breath for leave to subsist in their own land, to think their own thoughts, to sing their own songs, to garner the fruits of their own labors, and even while they beg, to see things inexorably withdrawn from them, then surely it is braver, a saner, and a truer thing to be a rebel in act and deed against such circumstances as these than tamely to accept it as the natural lot of men. My lord, I have done. Gentlemen of the jury, I wish to thank you for your verdict. I hope you will not take amiss what I have said, or think I made any imputation upon your truthfulness or your integrity when I spoke and said that this was not a trial by my peers. I maintain that I have a natural right to be tried in that natural jurisdiction, Ireland, my own country. And I would put it to you, how would you feel in the converse case if an Englishman had landed here in England and the Crown or the government, for its own purpose, had conveyed him secretly from England to Ireland under a false name, committed him to prison under a false name, and brought him before a tribunal in Ireland under a statute which they knew involved a trial before an Irish jury? How would you feel yourselves as Englishmen if that man was to be submitted to trial by a jury in a land inflamed against him and believing him to be a criminal, when his only crime was that he had cared for England more than for Ireland?
So it is morning already. Good morning, gentlemen.